Given the spiraling fears about pathogens, viruses, and diseases, and the 24/7 news cycle that feeds them, you might be convinced that there's nothing you can do to change the course of infection. You're a sitting duck with few options and little hope of preventing infection. Or it's just a matter of time before you succumb to serious illness. But nothing could be further from the truth. The reality is that infection is not the same as sickness. The fact that pathogens exist isn't the problem, and being solely focused on the enemy isn't the solution. We've got cultural tunnel vision around pathogens and disease, with every new strain and variant getting the kind of attention that usually accompanies the launch of a new iPhone. We're also singularly focused on which external factors can help us cope with disease. And while timely medical intervention can and has saved lives, that doesn't mean you're powerless in the meantime. You can do a lot to strengthen your innate ability to fight disease. You are so much stronger than you think. Your immune system is incredibly powerful and adaptive, and by keeping it firing on all pistons, you can do a lot to protect yourself from pathogens if and when you encounter them. And that's exactly what I'm going to teach you how to do in a new 7-week online workshop called How to Boost Your Immunity Naturally, featuring a powerful research-backed program for optimizing your immune system and protecting against infection. The workshop will start on Monday, January 31st, and run through the end of March. For all of the details about this powerful program, including an outline of what's in each of the 7 modules, go to cresser.co/immunity. That's cresser.co/immunity. Here are just a few highlights of what you'll learn. How to strengthen your immune system naturally. What to eat and avoid to heal your gut and boost your immunity. What to do to reduce the risk of COVID-19 infection and protocols for when you're exposed. How to stay healthy during cold and flu season. And the most potent and safe supplements for building immunity and protecting against infection. This deep dive workshop will give you the insights, strategies, tools, and support you need to optimize your immune system, prevent and address infections, and protect yourself against the growing number of immune challenges we face in the modern world. One more thing before we get into today's episode. We're offering a 25% early bird discount for the next 5 days only. So if you're planning to register, make sure to do it before Sunday, January 23rd at midnight Pacific time. Just go to cresser.co/immunity to learn more and secure your discount. I'm really excited to offer this to all of you, and I hope you can join us in the workshop. Hey everybody, Chris Cresser here. Welcome to another episode of Revolution Health Radio. This week, I'm going to do a solo show on a topic that we've received quite a few questions about over the past 6 or 7 months. I've spoken over the years and more recently about the harmful impacts of excess screen time for both kids and adults. And I've talked a fair amount about the steps that we as adults can take to reduce screen time. But a few listeners have written in to ask for ideas on how to limit screen use in kids, given how ubiquitous these technologies have become in their lives. And this has been even more true during the pandemic, when many kids have been isolated and kept at home, and screens have been their primary interfaces with their teachers, their friends, and their lives in general. So I'm going to share some ideas and tools that we found to be helpful in our family. And there are a couple of caveats here. The first is that this is definitely a work in progress. It's been a struggle for us. We found some things that have been effective, some things that have not been effective. And I think it's worth pointing out that we are products of our environment, and we're shaped by our environment, and we're influenced and affected by our environment, and we can't make, you know, kind of isolated changes in that environment and expect those changes to not be impacted by the circumstances or conditions of that environment. So that's a rather long-winded way of saying that if we find ourselves in a culture where these technologies are dominant and play an increasingly significant role in social interactions between children and, leisure activities and the way that kids learn and just about everything else, it's going to be difficult for us to address that on an individual level. These are systemic problems,
And certainly there are steps that we can take individually and as families to mitigate the impact of those technologies. But at the end of the day, you know, we're still subject to the influence of the environment that we live in. And so I think that's one of the most difficult aspects of this for parents. And it's something I talked with Cal Newport a little bit on the show that I did with him on this broader topic of technology in our lives. He also makes this point that in his experience, you know, purely individual steps that are taken to reduce screen time for adults, which is what he mostly talks about, are often not that effective because they ignore the importance of this context that we're discussing here. So that's the first caveat. The second caveat in what I'm going to share with you is that we as a family are pretty restrictive when it comes to this stuff. A lot of what we do might seem draconian or unrealistic to you, depending on your particular situation. If there's a spectrum where on one end is, you know, no boundaries at all and just giving kids, you know, 100% control over their own use of technology. And then on the other end of the spectrum is, you know, living in a cave in a remote area where there's absolutely no exposure to technologies for kids. I'd say we're not, you know, we're certainly not in the cave, but we're probably closer to that end of the spectrum than we are to the other end of the spectrum where there's just no limitation or boundaries at all. And I'm not saying here that our way is the only way, of course, or even the right way. Every family has to find what works for them, given their specific circumstances. And there will be a lot of variables that determine that. You know, one might be each particular child's relationship with technology and how susceptible they are to screen addiction or excess screen use interfering with other activities. The truth is that's not the same for every kid. Some kids are, you know, I think all kids are susceptible to some extent, just like all adults are susceptible, just because of our basic hardwired, you know, biological human programming. But within that susceptibility, there is definitely a range. There are kids who are very susceptible to this. And sadly, those kids can become the ones that deal with actual addiction and, you know, may end up in rehab for video game addiction or screen addiction of some sort. And it can really destroy their lives and their family's lives. On the other end of the spectrum, you have kids that are, you know, mildly susceptible in the way that all human beings are susceptible, but it doesn't really interfere with their lives. It doesn't get in the way of their normal human relationships. It doesn't get in the way of their physical activity, you know, spending time outdoors and all the other stuff that's important for kids to be doing. So that's one variable. Another variable will be their social context and friends. You know, one of the things that's hardest for us and that I hear from so many different families is limiting access to these technologies in many cases limits participation in the social activities that their friends are engaged in. And so as an example, I had a discussion several months back with a parent of a 16-year-old girl, and her 16-year-old girl was devastated because she felt like she had lost her best friend because her best friend had joined Instagram and was interacting a lot with other friends on Instagram. And this particular parent of this 16-year-old didn't want her daughter to be on Instagram and didn't allow it. And so she didn't have a phone that, you know, that had Instagram on it. And so, you know, over a relatively short period of just a few weeks, this parent felt, or the daughter basically felt like she was shut out from her relationship with her best friend because her friend wanted her to be on Instagram liking her posts and interacting with her like other friends were. So this is a real concern and a real impact that it has on kids' lives. And I think we need to have a lot of compassion and understanding for the position that they're in, because that's a really difficult circumstance to be in if you feel like your best friend is using these technologies and wanting to interact with them and you're not able to as a 16-year-old. That's really difficult. All human beings want to be included. That's another basic human trait. And as we all know, since we've all been teenagers ourselves, that impulse is especially strong and important during the teenage years. So, and I would say adolescent and even tween years as well. So, you know, being excluded from a context where, you know, most of your friends are participating and interacting is no small thing. And it's definitely something that we need to consider as we think about what the best response is as parents. So that's, you know, kind of a framework for how I think about it. And again, this is for me, for us, for many of our friends and, you know, my patients and people that I talk to about this. It's a moving target. It's something that needs to be reevaluated almost constantly. It's not the kind of thing where I think it shouldn't be the kind of thing where you come up with a policy and just implement it and forget about it. It's much more dynamic than that, and the conditions are often changing. So I'm going to give, you know, some ideas and tips here and share some of the technologies, ironically, that we use to limit technology access. And I'm just going to, you know, the final caveat will be this is a living, breathing set of kind of principles and guidelines, and I will definitely revisit it in the future as things continue to evolve for us. So the first principle is fairly simple, but I'm often surprised by how often it seems to be ignored, which is for parents to be in control of your kids' access to screens and technology. I believe that unrestricted, unlimited screen access, especially when that screen is connected to the internet and there are no boundaries on what apps can be installed, is a recipe for disaster. I think we have plenty of research to support this. We know that that's even true for adults. I mean, many of us struggle to limit our own use of these technologies, and even those of us who understand what the downsides are still struggle. And then when you give kids and teenagers that kind of unrestricted access, number one, they may not have the same ideas about the harms that can come from those technologies. So they are not necessarily even starting with the assumption that they should limit them. And number two, they have the incredible social pull that I just mentioned to be using them. And number three, their willpower and other internal resources for, you know, limiting their access, you know, controlling their own behavior, are often far less developed than those kinds of resources can be in adults. So for all of those reasons, I think that giving kids unrestricted access is a huge mistake, and it's really setting them up and setting you up for failure and a lot of problems down the line. So the first principle is just to be in control of access, and there are different ways to do this. One, of course, is not to give your kids their own devices in the first place, like phones or tablets, and only allow them to use yours at certain times and for certain periods that you designate. Now, this has some downsides, of course, especially as kids get older. You have to be very much involved and in control, and that, you know, there can be a lot of power struggles around that. You also may not want your kids in your devices and, you know, potentially reading your emails or text messages or things like that. So I think that, you know, this particular strategy can work for very young kids, although I would also argue that for very young kids, they shouldn't really have much screen access at all, particularly unsupervised screen access. But when kids get older, it's, you know, in many cases, it's going to make more sense for them to have their own device, whatever that might be. But to use, again, here's the irony, use technology, particularly software, to control and limit their access to those devices. So let me give a specific example. In our family, our daughter is 10 at the time of this recording, 10 and a half. She doesn't have her own phone yet, although she would very much like to have one. And she likely won't have her own phone until she's 15 or 16. Again, this puts us in the absolute minority. Some would call us neo-Luddites, but it's a choice we've made based on consideration of many of the variables that I mentioned earlier in the recording. She does have her own iPad, and we use an app called Our Pact, that's OURPACT, that allows us to set limits on the overall amount of time that she can spend on the device, and also what apps can be used, whether she can download new apps herself, she cannot, whether she can do in-app purchases, she cannot, and several other variables. So it's a pretty powerful app. It's not perfect. I have some quibbles with it, but I've looked at and used virtually all of the similar apps, and I keep coming back to using Our Pact for this purpose. So you can set it up. For example, let's say you want to have, give your kids a half hour or an hour of screen access a day, or 2 hours of screen access a day. You can do that. You could also have different limits on the weekends versus during the week. You can also block out certain hours. So let's say you don't want them accessing the iPad in the morning when they're getting ready for school, or and maybe you want to set blackout hours at night. So like after 8 p.m., there's no access until the following day after school at 3 p.m. or whatever you're going to do. It's very easy to do that with our pact. Then from there you can configure what apps they have access to, and that can even be done at for specific times a day. So you could decide, for example, to have only certain apps available in the morning, or on the weekend, or after school, or what have you. So pretty specific set of controls. There's also now built-in controls in iOS and probably Android. I'm not an Android user, so I don't know much about it, but I assume at this point that they have a similar function. In iOS, this is called screen time. And you can use this for yourself to control or limit your own screen time. You can also use it for your kids. And we use both. It's a little complicated. I'm not even sure I can explain it here. But there are features that are available in Screen Time that are not available in Our Pact, and vice versa. So we ended up kind of cobbling together a solution where we use both, and it works pretty well. It was a lot of trial and error for us, and there are lots and lots of variables, which is again why I can't really explain it in detail here. But Screen Time, for example, allows us to limit entire groups of apps. And I found that in some cases the time limiting factor works a little bit better than it does with Our Pact. One important thing to note here is that for either of these apps to work well, the devices need to be connected to the internet, because that's how it sort of calls back to the parent device. So, with Our Pact, you'll have it installed on the child's device, and then you'll have an app on your device, and you can control all of the access settings from your device. And from the child's device, that's how it sort of calls back to the internet, I think, to enforce the limits. And if it's not connected to the internet, then there's no limit. And this is a downside, I think, of the app, and I've written them about it, but seems to be a limitation in how it's programmed. And this can come up, like let's say you're on a long drive and you only want, your kid to be able to watch a movie for a couple hours, and then you want them to do something else for the remainder of the drive. Unless that iPad has a cellular connection that allows it to, be connected while you're driving, then that limit will not, it won't enforce, basically. Your kid will be able to continue using the iPad for until you get back to somewhere where there's an internet connection. So that's something to be aware of. Workaround is getting a cellular connection for that device. And I think Screen Time does a better job of that. It seems like sometimes that the limit will still be enforced even if there's not an internet connection. But to be honest, I haven't been able to fully figure that out yet. It seems like sometimes it works, and and sometimes it doesn't. But between both of these tools, you can have a lot of fine-grained control over what your kids are accessing and for how long. Hey, everybody. I want to tell you a little bit about one of my favorite companies, Paleo Valley. I've been a huge fan of their products since they started. Their Bee Sticks are a family favorite on hikes, camping trips, and other outings, and their Organ Delight supplement is a fantastic way to get the benefits of eating organ meats for those that don't love the taste of liver. And I confess, I happen to be one of those, as is our daughter. Paleo Valley shares my values around food and supplements, and I can always trust them to have the highest quality and best sourced ingredients. So if you'd like to check out their products, head over to paleovalley.com/Chris to get 15% off your first order. So the second principle is to control your kids' access to the internet and to certain apps. So not all online activities are equal when it comes to their potential negative impact on kids. Streaming music, for example, or taking photos or organizing photos, those are far different in terms of how they affect kids than using Instagram or TikTok. A lot of the studies we've seen and work from people like Jonathan Haidt and even Facebook's own research has shown that there are uniquely harmful effects of social media like Instagram and TikTok that particularly impact tween and teenage girls because they plug into the strong need for belonging that I mentioned earlier, and kids can start to just, you know, organize their lives around getting likes for what they post, and if they don't get likes, it, you know, deeply affects their self-esteem. And you know, that is so much worse and so different than taking pictures or listening to music or even texting. So that's, you know, the first thing to be aware of. We're not talking about, you know, universal restriction to all technologies in the same way. It makes sense to restrict access to those technologies which present the greatest threat and can cause the greatest harm. So again, apps like HourPack that I just mentioned, and then Screen Time, which is built into iOS, can both provide access to and limit access to certain apps. And I think it's a really good idea to use these tools for this reason. Along the same lines, HourPack and Screen Time can also block your child from purchasing and downloading new apps from the App Store, which you definitely want to do, because otherwise your kid's just going to work around this pretty quickly. Most kids are savvy with technology, and you know, if they're able to get on there and download whatever apps they want and use those apps or do in-app purchases, then, you know, whatever efforts you've done to prevent that from happening will be moot. Another option for controlling access to the internet and certain apps is to buy something like a Gab phone or a Gab watch. So this is a company that has created phones and watches that are specifically designed for kids. These devices limit the number of contacts that a kid could have. So for example, with the Gab watch, they can only have 10 contacts. They can't add new contacts. So that is safer. It you know, prevents a lot of stuff from happening that you might not want to happen. There's also a mode on the Gab watch where the only thing that the child can do is to call an emergency number that you designate, which could be your own number, your partner's number. And when it's in that mode, you know, it just functions basically as a watch and as an emergency device. And you can set hours for usage. So let's say you don't want your kid using the watch during the day while they're at school. You could set it so that, you know, they can only have the full use of it from, like, you know, 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. or something every day. And then, you know, with the phone has more functionality than the watch. It's got music. It's got, you know, more contacts. They can send text messages. They can make calls. But they cannot install Instagram and other social media apps on the phone. It's just not possible to do that with the Gab phones. So this has become a pretty popular option for a lot of parents. And then the watch is also a popular option for younger kids, whereas, in the case that where you don't necessarily want your child having full access to a phone yet, but you do want them to be able to make calls, which you can do with the Gab watch to the 10 contacts that are preloaded that the parents can load, and to be able to send simple emoji-based text messages or pre-configured messages. So they have you have a set of pre-configured messages that you can determine and write and load into the watch. And so they could be like, I'm on my way home, or can you come pick me up, or something like that. And then the kid can just choose from those pre-configured messages. And then the kid can also record a voice memo or a voice message that will be sent to you as a text message, but it will show up as an audio recording. So I think that's a really great starter option. We are, again, at the time of this recording, considering that for our 10-year-old. We're not ready for a phone, even a Gab phone for her, but we are considering a watch, and there's a lot of controls, and it makes, I think, provides some of the benefit of being able to participate in social interaction. Some of her friends already have phones. Certainly a lot of them have watches or things like that, and she wants to be able to call them or communicate with them. And when I think back on my own childhood and my wife, we both talk about this. By the time we were 10 or 11, we were using our landlines to call friends, and we were able to communicate with them in that way. Most people now don't have landlines, and that's really not an option. So if we want our kids to be able to, call their friends and communicate with them in that way, then something like a Gab watch, which permits that but doesn't allow many of the more harmful aspects of technology for younger kids, like access to social media, I think that may be a really good compromise for a lot of different parents and kids. And then the last principle or question is just simply, how much time should you allow your kid to be engaged with the screen? Now, this is a very personal choice, and of course, it depends on all of the variables that we mentioned before. And if you ask 10, even 10 experts, psychologists and people who study this and write about it and talk about it a lot, you're going to get 10 different answers. So there's nothing universal here. And again, I think it depends a lot on the kid's temperament. I think the research is pretty clear that young kids under the age of 2 should not really have any screen time at all. So this, all this baby Mozart stuff, and sometimes when I go out to a restaurant and I see, a family with a 1-year-old propped up on a high chair with a phone on their little tray in front of them, I cringe, because there's a lot of evidence that suggests that that is not beneficial and is harmful for the neurodevelopment, brain development of kids that age. As kids start to get older, the range of potential screen time that experts suggest is, gets broader and broader, again, depending on who you listen to. In our case, we really want our daughter to be spending as much time interacting with the real physical world as possible, which means being outside, staying active, playing with friends in person, and then things like reading books, making art, playing music. We feel that these kinds of activities are best for her brain development, for her social development, for her development as a human being. We want her to have an experience of life that is primarily unmediated by technology. We want her to have time for reverie and contemplation. We want her to feel bored, because as I've talked about before and written about before, boredom is actually a precondition for creativity and innovation. Like, being able to tolerate those moments where you don't know what to do, you're not engaged in a particular activity, and you start to feel that sensation that we refer to as boredom. Some of the richest and, most unpredictable experiences can come out of that. And the one of the the things that concerns me most about these technologies that we have access to for adults and for kids is that if we want to, we can completely avoid that experience, those experiences of boredom, those quiet moments where we might just gaze out the window and we go into that kind of default mode network where we're unconsciously reviewing our lives and our experiences, and that's generating new ideas and new perspectives. I think that that kind of time is absolutely essential to being human, and I'm concerned that there are entire generations now that are being raised with these technologies, which can essentially completely obliterate that time. You know, so let's say you're in line at the store, and you might, you know, be in a situation where you would have those kinds of moments, but you can just whip out your phone and see what's new. Similarly, like if you're riding in a car, like as many of us did when we were kids, just looking out the window, at this point, you know, so many kids are just watching a video or on their phone in the car. Really, anytime there's any feeling of discomfort or just space at all in one's life, we can look at our phone. And I think that the harms of this are not even fully understood yet and won't be for some time, but I'm pretty alarmed by it. And, you know, I see it in both adults and kids. You know, I was just at a restaurant the other day and there was a family, and the entire family was on their phones for the entire time. And there were moments where, you know, someone would put their phone down and then sort of look around, see that other people were on their phones and pick it up again. There were moments where you could see someone going through a kind of internal, or at least I was projecting that they were going through an internal process where they're like, okay, I probably shouldn't be using my phone as much. So they put the phone down, but then, you know, a couple moments pass, there's some discomfort arises. They pick up the phone again. And, you know, I don't mean to judge or to call this particular family out, because we all struggle with this, including me, but it's an indicator for me of where we're at in the world that we're living in. And I think that if we were, let's say, to transport ourselves from 30 or 40 years ago, prior to the advent of these technologies, and, you know, travel into the future and then, you know, just be a passive observer standing in that restaurant looking at what's happening, we would have been horrified and shocked. It would have been like a bad sci-fi movie, where we see that that's the nature of human interaction now, and even just relationship with ourselves is just completely interfered with by these technologies. And I feel like we've been the proverbial frogs in the boiling water, where these changes they've taken place quickly, but not like overnight. So we've had, I don't think we're even fully aware of how dramatically they have interfered with our lives. And if you think of that kind of thought experiment where you know, go from 30 or 40 years ago, those of us who are old enough to remember what life was like before these technologies, and you fast forward quickly, it would be a shocking change. And so, you know, we definitely fall on the end of the spectrum of limiting access to these technologies and wanting our daughter to have significant periods of time where she's not interacting with them at all. And that's true on a day-to-day basis, but it's also true on like a you know, more extended time frame. So I've talked about this a lot before, but we do digital, you know, complete screen-free times as a family. We've been worse on this in the pandemic, but prior to that, you know, Sundays were kind of sacred screen-free days for everybody, and then we would do more extended periods, like in the summer we'll often do like a multi-day rafting trip or a backcountry trip where we're just in nature and we're not interacting with phones or screens at all. And I can tell you that even when our daughter was younger than she is now, she, at the end of those trips, she would express that she didn't want to leave those environments. And so she, even at a young age, was able to experience how different life feels when you're in that kind of vital, essential relationship to the physical world, to nature, to other people. And, you know, she would say things like, Papa, I don't want to leave the river, which is just, you know, it's a pretty powerful expression of just our own innate knowledge of what's good for us. And so I think it's really important to carve out screen-free times on a daily basis, more extended periods on a weekly or monthly basis, and then longer chunks of time, maybe on an annual or semi-annual basis, where your kids and you are not experiencing life mediated by a screen, because that has been become such a dominant experience for most of us. All right, so those are my current thoughts. I hope this has been helpful. And again, you know, want to emphasize how this is a living, breathing process. We've changed and continue to change our approach here. You know, for example, right now we're not really doing much screen time at all on a daily basis for our daughter. We have a family movie night on Saturday nights, and she's got maybe a half hour, an hour on one or two other days during the week, depending on the week. But we've had other times where she had an hour a day and was largely, you know, could you know, watch movies or, you know, do some other stuff. But yeah, it's just, we're just constantly monitoring, seeing how it's working for her, for our family, and then making changes accordingly. So I would definitely invite you to do the same. It does require more thought process, more discussion. It becomes a larger topic of conversation, but I think it's really important to do that. The second thing about that I would suggest is including your child once they're old enough in those conversations. We've talked a lot with our daughter about the impacts of these technologies. She's even watched The Social Dilemma, which was probably, you know, she was a bit young for it when she saw it, but we really wanted her to see it. I've talked to her about, you know, my work and studies about technology and screen addiction. She's very well aware of all of that stuff. And that doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean that she still doesn't want to use these technologies. Of course, that's not going to change her desires. It's that all that stuff is sort of operating on an intellectual level. She understands it on an intellectual level, but her desires and impulses for these technologies are coming from a lower part of the brain, and you know, part of, you know, very deep human desires to interact with other people socially and be part of something, etc. So don't expect to, you know, explain these things to your kids and then have them all of a sudden change their behavior. That doesn't work for most adults, and so we can't expect it to work for kids. Nevertheless, I think it is important to include them in the conversation. And, you know, I think you'll find that when you do that, you'll hear your kids in various contexts mentioning, maybe to other people or even to you, things that you've shared with them in the past. And that's an indicator that they're taking it in some form or capacity. All right, that's it for today, everyone. Thanks for listening. Please keep sending in your questions to chriskresser.com/podcast question. We'll talk to you next time. That's the end of this episode of Revolution Health Radio. If you appreciate the show and want to help me create a healthier and happier world, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. They really do make a difference. If you'd like to ask a question for me to answer on a future episode, you can do that at chriskresser.com/podcast question. You can also leave a suggestion for someone you'd like me to interview there. If you're on social media, you can follow me at twitter.com/chriskresser or facebook.com/chriskresserlac. I post a lot of articles and research that I do throughout the week there that never makes it to the blog or podcast, so it's a great way to stay abreast of the latest developments. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.